Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and you're very welcome to this week's edition of the Group Chat Podcast from Virgin Media News. I am political correspondent Gavin Riley, joined in studio by news correspondent Zara King.
Hello, how are you?
And by news correspondent and the doyen of Donegal hen parties all over the land,
oi, oi.
Richard Chambers.
Hello. Good.
That's a reference to other podcasts, which people should definitely listen to when they're finished catching up with this week. Richard's excellent appearance on Dear Gary's Last of Your Life. Do you want to tell people the hen story party very quickly?
No, it'll take too long. But well, no, actually, you know, go on. It was 2016 or something like that. I was on election coverage in Donegal. To spin a long thread into a shorter one, I got into a bit of car trouble where I was waiting a long time for a rescue from the AA. Mm. Not an ad because they weren't good.
but well, like roadside rescuers are available.
They're probably still insuring my car. Maybe I shouldn't say these things. But basically, I was rescued by a Donegal hen party who appeared like an apparition out of nowhere in the lashings of rain in Donegal and shunted my car with a bit of a heave out of the pickle that it was in. And then we were afterwards reunited. And feather boas and pink Stetsons are apparently the only year.
The day they were delighted with me.
Yeah, they're anytime. Like, I remember because I was initially, there was a bit of a thing about I need to get in contact with them just so I can thank them properly.
Mm. Yeah,
and I think BBC Ulster brought us together eventually after a number of days of campaigning. We had nothing better to do.
So if you want to see Richard Chambers with feather boas and a pink Stetson, Google Images is your friend on that front. It's been a really busy news week, so we've lots to get through. But actually, there was one particular issue which struck a chord with a lot of us immediately when it came out, and definitely seems to have struck a chord with a lot of our listeners as well. And those are comments made by Leo Varadkar at the weekend, where he discussed this idea that a lot of people considering emigrating might actually not end up emigrating at all. And as he said in his own words, the grass can look greener. Now, this was on...
Who did you make those comments to, Gavin?
He made those comments on... I always try to make a point of not having cross-pollination where, like, I don't try to use...
He said it on Gavin's
to promote
radio.
My show.
He said it to me.
I also program on News Talk on Sunday mornings, and he said it to me. He was in with me on the weekend. And he told me on News Talk that the grass isn't always greener, because I put to him that there was a new Red Sea poll which showed that 2/3 of people aged between 18 and 25 and about 1/3 of people aged between 25 and 35 were considering leaving the country. And he said that it might be the case that if you go to a very rural area or a third or fourth tier city, that life might be more affordable. His words, not mine. But that can be true in Ireland too, he said. Sometimes the grass looks greener. It's not the case that more Irish people are leaving Ireland than coming home. Actually, more Irish citizens are coming home. So the grass can look greener, and considering emigration is not the same as actually doing it. Now, I've checked the stats and it is true that there is net inward flow of Irish people. Mm. So in the year up to April, about 29,000 Irish people came home from abroad, a little under 28,000 left. So there's a slight inflow of Irish citizens. But the idea that a lot of people wouldn't consider leaving, or this idea that the grass may not be greener, is something that has exercised a lot of our listeners, Richard.
Yes, but I want to ask you, because you were there when it happened, and obviously people will have seen this, and I think it would be hard to not have seen this over the last number of days since he said it. Mm. When you were listening to him and he was giving you that answer in the interview, what was your feeling? Did you realise that was quite a significant thing, or that would be something which is going to be a real touchstone of anger for people?
In truth, my gut reaction was, I wish I had seen this coming so that I could have had facts and figures to hand, because it's one of those things where you can't empirically prove or disprove it in the spur of the moment.
So
you're able to say, right, pause the clock, here's another Bernard's watch reference. If you pause the watch for a second while I go off and checked the Spanish and Italian and British and German versions of Daft to see what's the going rate in all those places. That in truth was my gut reaction. I did suspect that it might raise a few eyebrows. I don't think to the effect that it has done, because certainly a lot of our listeners have been very irked by that contention by the Tánaiste.
They sure have. Group chat listeners in all of the corners of the world answered the call. Gavin, they heard us looking for their stories of rental wonders abroad in comparison to the situations that they left back here, And they were very exercised by what Leo Varadkar had to say, and rightly so, I suppose. If you look at the stats, it is worth saying off the top of the of all of this is that if you compare rents in Dublin, to use the city that, you know, Leo Varadkar is mostly talking about, with other cities in Europe, and not just specifically one city in North America, not good comparison, I would say. The grass certainly is greener in terms of what's available and what is rental protection in other countries. And that is what our listeners had to say. So a lot of people joined the group chat this week, and here's some of their own experiences of renting abroad.
Yeah, I'm living in Bonn in Western Germany. It's about half an hour away from Cologne, and I'm paying a fraction of what is being paid for the equivalent in Dublin, Galway, Cork. So it's very difficult for me to see how I'm ever going to be able to move back to Ireland, because I just genuinely don't think I'll ever be able to afford a room of this standard in Ireland, which is really, really kind of proves how incorrect Leo Varadkar's statement was.
I made the move from Dublin to Berlin in 2020, and to be honest, I haven't really looked back. And like, you'd meet Irish people here or even German friends, and you kind of have a bit of a laugh looking at like what's going up on Irish websites now. You know, the showers and living rooms, the 1,000 euro sheds that people are living in, the shed sits.
I currently live by myself in a one bedroom apartment in downtown Toronto, and I pay approximately after conversion about 1,400 euro a month in rent. And then on top of that, my bills are about 100 euro. So that would include my heat, my electricity, phone, and my internet. And then within the rent itself, I have access to all the amenities of my building, which are a gym, a pool, there are guest suites we can rent, there is a party room we can rent out. When I looked at what's available in Dublin, it would be about 2,500 euro to live anything comparably. I know for a fact that if I was to move home tomorrow, I would definitely have to share it with someone, or I would have to move back in with my parents. There's really no other option.
So where I'm living, I'm just living essentially directly in the city centre in an area called Sol, which is right next to Gran Vía, which is like the main street of Madrid. So I'm house sharing, I'm not living by myself, I'm sharing with four others. I pay just 440 euro, and then 50 euro on like electricity and gas as a fixed cost. So just 490 altogether. And to be honest, seeing Leo Varadkar's comments, it does feel like the grass is greener.
Like someone like myself who's moved to Amsterdam, I'm well aware it's not a cheap city. I didn't come here to save money on rent. I know that. I came here to get something that's safe, something that's cozy, comfy and nice, that young people have a good chance to get somewhere good. So, I mean, okay, the grass is not greener in terms of price, but it's gone so far beyond just price. It's supply and demand, regulation. It's the whole environment around renting is so unstable in Dublin, and he doesn't address that at all.
It's just so interesting that they're so vexed by it, that they are so willing to come on and to talk about it so openly, Richard. I mean, like, you really didn't have a lot of difficulty getting people to open up about this.
No.
One thing I just want to pick up on that I heard in that, the term shed sit.
It wasn't what I'd heard before.
I'd never heard it before.
But I'm not at all surprised that someone has coined a term for it, because, I mean, how many times have you seen ads going viral in the last 6 or 12 or 18 months of somebody basically renting out a Wendy house for over a grand a month? So I'm not at all surprised. But like, isn't that even more so, maybe not even the cost or the location that you get, the fact that property is so hard to get in Dublin, that there are people who will rent a shed to sleep in.
But even as we were listening there, you were like, the girl in Toronto is at 1,400 a month for own place. There's a gym.
Yeah,
there's a couple of good amenities and that. You're like, not bad for a gym. Like, you would so not get that in Dublin. Absolutely not.
You
want staff, you'll see like places that are like supposedly studio apartments, and like the oven touches the bed, and you're like 1,800 a month standard. Like, it's outrageous.
It is. And you mentioned there that people were vexed about this. And I think there's actually, it gets a bit worse than that, because people, and the people who sent in those clips, and thanks again, everybody who did contribute
there. We love when people send
voice notes are brilliant. It really adds a lot to the program. But they're upset and they're angered because, first of all, they didn't want to leave. Mm-hmm. People would ideally spend their time in their home country or home city.
Sorry, but I would say the government would often say, oh, young people love to travel, so they want to go. And that's always, you know, there's going to be young people who want to go out and adventure and experience the world. And you're like, well, actually, those people are telling you they couldn't afford to stay here any longer.
And some people will. If even accepted that some people do just want to get out there and see the world, completely understandable thing for some people to do. People who answered us said they didn't want to leave and their situation meant that they couldn't afford to stay here and that they could get somewhere much more comfortable, much more agreeable and still have a good career and good standard of living and better than they would in this country. But the point is that they are angered by what Leo Varadkar said because they don't believe that they'll be able to come back in the near future because of what we're seeing. Obviously, the Daft thing was out this week. Record level of rent increases. The people who make that report say the fact that we have such a shortage of rental properties means that the increases are going to continue.
You mentioned that people were particularly vexed as well by the nature of one of the specific comparisons and a city in North America, because Leo Varadkar also said, if you're going to another successful, busy city or country, you will see a lot of the same problems. You know, you're not going to find that rents are lower in New York or that it's easier to buy a house in Sydney. And that may be true on a sort of a superficial level, but again, people have been contesting this idea that the grass isn't greener there either.
Yes, I mean, it is a hell of a pull. To pick out specifically New York City as
like
the comparison
one of the
for Dublin.
Cities in the world.
Infamously expensive city, infamously big, buzzy city. Everything is happening there.
Yeah.
Like, why are we, like, he was making comparison saying you won't get better in anywhere else than you would in Dublin, that it would have to be a tier two or three or four city. What's Dublin in comparison to New York? And that's not being insulting to Dublin.
City,
I'm sorry, it's not a comparison. But the fact is, some people who were in contact with us and who put out their views online said they were able to get comparable rents in Dublin as they would in New York or vice versa. But also, I want to share one really considered contribution on this. This is from Claude de May, who got in touch with us, longtime listener of the programme. Here's her experience of living in New York and what she had to feel about what Leo Varadkar said.
Okay, so I'm 27 and I immigrated to New York in September. I had been living in Dublin until May and I moved home for the summer to save so I could move. I'd only moved back to Dublin in October 2021, having lived there pre-pandemic, but after 8 months I was struggling and was genuinely fed up of the state of things, and to be honest, they're just getting worse too. Out of a group of 14 of my friends at home, 8 of us have immigrated or will be doing so in the next 3 months. I remember I got laughed at a lot when I said that I was immigrating to New York because the cost of living was too high in Dublin, when obviously here it's notorious for being a high cost of living, but my response was that at least my standard of living will be higher. Like, the grass may not be greener because it's a concrete jungle, ha ha ha, but like, I have a lot more going for me here, despite being a woman in the United States and the various other controversial policies in place over here. I live in Queens, so it's 20 kilometres from where I'm working at the moment, but like, my commute is consistently between 40 and 50 minutes on public transport at any hour of the day or night. Compared to, I was paying $800 for a small box room in Dublin 8. Wages are higher as well here, so like the €400 difference in rent or the €300 difference in rent and bills, you can see it straight away. Most of my family are in healthcare and like they're nearing retirement age, and I would have been very friendly with the medicine and nursing classes that graduated in 2018, 2019 out of UCC, and I only know 3 of them that are still in the country out of, like, I knew at least 100 of them, and there's only 3 of them still in the country. And I don't know if anyone else has plans to stay either.
The sentiment from Claude there totally echoes what we're seeing in the figures from the INMO. They had done a recent survey where they said, I think it was 60-odd% of graduates were planning to emigrate. So it really does actually tally that account from her of what we're actually seeing in the stats.
And that may be perhaps in its own way slightly unrepresentative because it is only in one particular sector, but it's a sector that we've been talking about on this programme and in plenty of other places that we urgently need people to stay here, that we spend loads of money giving these people really high quality training. But if we can't make it worth their while to stay in the country, then, you know, we're all going to be goosed, aren't we?
Now, like, the government will come back, right? And they will argue, and I'm sure you'll come around to this, that, you know, Housing for All is working. We're going to meet our housing targets. We're making the future better for young people to be able to live here.
Leo Varadkar also conceded on the programme on Sunday that he's worried that we're not going to meet next year's targets.
Right.
He's like, oh, you know, there is light, the green shoots coming through, but we're going to fail next year's targets. So that's...
Do you think that under-promise, over-achieve type preemptive? Like, do you think that's a bit of that?
I don't think they can afford to do that.
Well, so I was at the launch of the Shangana Castle development earlier this week. I was saying that to you, and the Taoiseach was at that. And so this is basically one of the biggest kind of public housing developments they turned the sod on it the other day, and so it's going to be 600 units or 600 houses and apartments. The first one will be delivered by the end of 2024. The goal is to make it affordable for households who have a combined income of around 52,000. So, you know, so people are earning that. So they are kind of moving towards that, but it's still a very long way off. And like 600 seems kind of big, but like when you look at the scale of the problem and the amount of like record numbers of people living in hotel rooms and emergency accommodation, it's like it's such a drop in the ocean, unfortunately. And it's not to be negative about it, but it's obviously a very positive thing, but like it's just not happening fast enough, and that's the problem.
As well as that, when you mention, as Clodagh did in the message and what you were talking about in terms of what the INMO is saying, it's worth reflecting on the fact that the like six of the country's main teachers' unions were also out this week saying that because of the mishandling, in their view, of the housing situation, that the education of the country is going to suffer because of this, because teachers don't have affordable places to live to be able to get to work and to educate our kids in a good way. That's something which has been reflected, not just by the teachers' unions, not just by the INMO, by Garda's unions as well.
The Garda unions is an important point, because did you see the email that we once again got to the newsroom today from a police force in Australia that was asking us unironically to promote the fact that they were now recruiting among members of an Garda Síochána to go and work in Australia, because even though they have jobs here, that they would have a better standard of life, where things would be more affordable for them on the other side of the planet.
It is. But like, I mean, this is why, and to sort of bring it back, I mean, when Leo Varadkar says this sort of stuff on your radio program, and there's somehow some surprise that people are angered by it. What do you expect? People are in a situation where they can't afford to live in their country. They're not able to commute to the jobs that they want to work in, which are vital jobs for us to have.
Their families and their networks and their communities, like that's really important too. Let's not underestimate the fact that when you move away, like you move away from that support network, and that's a really big factor in that. It's not just about money and housing. It's about like that emotional support that you need from your friends and family that you, you know, will still get via the phone, I'm sure, when you're away, but you don't get that when you leave the country.
Yeah. Silly thing to say, absolutely not true.
Well, thank you for inviting me to promote my radio show. Anyway, thanks to Clodagh and everyone
else. We love his radio show. It's on Saturday, Sunday.
It is Sunday morning, 11 to 1 on News Talk. Thank you to Clodagh and everyone else who sent in voice notes. And definitely, the next time we do a call to action, please do send them in, because they do, as Richard said, add an awful lot to the programme. Now, we've been saying for a few weeks on the group chat that we wanted to discuss in a little bit more depth some of the ongoing events in Iran, something which were highlighted by the protest by the Iranian national football team when they declined to sing the national anthem before their opening World Cup game against England on Monday. I'm delighted to say that we have someone in studio to talk about all of this in a little bit more depth. Aida Younesi is a software engineer who's been living in Dublin for the last 2 years, but who is an Iranian citizen and has been following events in her home country very closely. Aida, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us this week on the group chat. Let's go back to the very beginning, because let's just assume that not everyone has been keeping up with events that in your home country. In your own words, how would you explain what's been going on for the last few weeks there?
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting us. So it all started on September 13th when Mahsa Amini, or Jina Amini, a young 22 years old Kurdish Iranian girl, traveled to Tehran, the capital city, and she got arrested by the morality police. Just because, according to them, she was not wearing the hijab properly. And then she went to coma, and a few days later, on 16th of September, she was announced dead. And what is believed by most Iranian people is that the morality police brutally beaten up that girl, and it caused her like brain damage, and she died after that. But the claim from the government propaganda is that she had underlying medical issues and she suffered a heart attack, while her father, Mahsa's father, denied all these claims, and he mentioned that there was no medical condition in her life. She didn't have any medical problems, and these are all propaganda. So after that, it all triggered a national-wide protest in Iran that now we call it a revolution, because it's past the time that it's a lot more widely happening in Iran, and it's targeting nowadays the whole regime. People, they don't want this regime anymore. They want the regime change.
Just to explain a little bit more about the current regime that is in Iran, and a term there that you mentioned, which would be news to a lot of people as well, the idea of a morality police. Mm. Can you explain exactly what is the role of morality police in Iran?
Yeah, that might sound actually really weird if I start describing it. And I have firsthand experience when I was back home in Iran that I was trying to escape them, like just because the coat that I was wearing was a bit shorter than the knee height. I knew that I get arrested, so I saw their van. So they usually have vans in several areas, especially in the capital city, but in a lot of other cities too. And they just look at girls and they try to assess if your hijab is proper enough or not. And it's completely.
And what is the differentiation between their interpretation of proper or not? I mean, so what are women expected to be? What's the criteria that the constant pressure that they're under to meet all the time?
So it's basically you need to cover all your hair and you need to cover most of your body. You're allowed to show your face, just the face and your hands up to the wrist. But whatever else it needs to be covered. And when they say it's not proper, it's kind of, it's up to them to decide if it's proper or not. Sometimes if you wear really colorful stuff, it might just attract their attention and they want to like arrest you and claiming that you are not wearing proper hijab. So it's kind of really really biased, and it's up to a human being to decide if your hijab is proper. And the whole concept is bogus because not everyone believes in wearing hijab, and people, they need to have the right to choose if they want to wear it at all or if they want to wear it properly or not. It's their choice.
When you say, you mentioned your own experience then with the morality police. I mean, would you see them if you were walking around, say, the streets of Tehran? Mm. Would you see them regularly, the morality police? I mean, is there a level of fear then that people have of bumping into these guys?
Yeah, definitely. So where I used to live back then when I was with my parents, probably Iranian people, they know Valias Square, which is one of the squares, main ones in Tehran. And they were always around that square, at least two or three vans. And I knew that. So I tried to avoid that square as much as I can, rerouting my route to one of the alleys to just like skip them. And it's absolutely fear when you see them, even though I'm like, I don't believe that my hijab is not proper. I still fear them.
So it's a looming, it's a constant looming presence.
Exactly.
And you come into contact with them and you're arrested, who comes to help you? I mean, is there a solicitor? Who comes to help women in these situations, or are you sort of left to fend for yourself?
Yeah. So usually they ask you to call parents or a guardian to come and help you, to bring you proper clothing and hijab, proper hijab. And they ask you to sign a paper that you are like promising that I'm going to wear hijab from now on properly. And in some cases, they may charge you some fines, some money. So that's usually the process. And because it's not really transparent, a lot of things can happen. A lot of, in case of Mahsa, she was unfortunately killed by them. So because the whole process is not transparent and it's up to the people doing it, and they are usually not really nice people.
Is it fair to say that whatever protest that there may have been about the morality police first and the death of Mahsa, that it's now become a much broader uprising against not just the morality police themselves, but the whole system behind them, behind the president, behind the supreme leader?
Exactly, yeah. You're absolutely right. Even if you think about the main slogan of this protest, which is woman, life, freedom, it's not only about like women body or the right to choose or morality police. It's about life and freedom. It was just a trigger to surface all the inequalities that has been going on in Iran for 43 years. Like the inequalities between different ethnicities, different religions. If you are like Christian or if you are Muslim, you get treated completely differently. And the main inequality, or the most widespread inequality, is the inequality between men and women. Half of the population, they don't have their rights. So it was just a trigger to target the whole system, the whole regime, for all the inequalities and brutalities that they caused over the 43 years.
And Ida, people have seen in previous years that there have been smaller scale revolutions, there's been smaller scale protests against the Islamic Republic, against the regime in Iran. What's different about this time that we have, you know, captured the world's imagination with this, that it has gone on for so long, and if anything, it's only picked up momentum? What's changed? What's different about this time?
That's a good question. I think one main aspect of it is just how widespread it is in Iran, how big. And as you mentioned, it's been going on. It's now in the third month that it's going on. And the other thing is that the brutality that the regime is showing right now, they so far killed more than 400 people and more than 50 children. This is not acceptable anywhere. I don't know how to describe it. And I think it's both that, and also people in Iran, they are completely disappointed in the whole system. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't want a reform or anything. They absolutely want a complete change.
What's your own family's involvement in the protest? How have they seen things develop over the last number of weeks and months?
So I keep calling them regularly and ask them what they see in Tehran and what they hear, just want to know what's going on. And they say that, yeah, the streets are usually busy with people protesting. The internet connection is another thing. Mm-hmm. They try to censor it or reduce the bandwidth.
Is that to stop people organizing?
Exactly, organizing or sharing news with outside world. Like, if you see the videos more often, if you see that how the regime is killing people, how the regime is using war-like weapon on civilians, then it's not good for the regime. So they want to stop it to happen. And yeah, one other example that they give me is that around 9 p.m., 10 p.m., people, they go on their windows or on the rooftop and they shout that to dictator, down with Khamenei, who is the supreme leader, and these sort of slogans.
Do you worry about your family? Do you worry about them? Obviously, you left home, I think it was 6 years ago, you were saying, and yeah, you got to visit a little bit in the first couple of years, but now not so much. And you're pursuing your career now, and you know, but obviously your family must be always on your mind. I mean, you love them. Do you worry about them sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because I have a brother, 22 years old, in prison right now, in Evin prison, with bogus charges. I worry about him a lot. I worry about my family, their well-being, everything, and my friends. I have so many friends and previous colleagues and family all in Iran, in different cities. And whenever I read news, like, oh, the Kurdish area is getting bombarded, and I know I have friends, and I feel shattered. I want to reach them, and I want to call them, and it's sometimes possible, sometimes it's not.
We mentioned the protest that the soccer team had undertaken on Monday. Given the controls on the internet, is that something that people at home are able to be aware of? Or what sort of impact do you think it will have if people in Iran are able to see on a worldwide scale the sort of protest that there is?
Yeah, definitely. They got the message from the football team, but obviously it was not enough. There is a feeling that this football team was completely, before the World Cup, they were, they met the current president of the regime, and so it might not be enough, but it was heartwarming for people to see.
There's been a couple of other high profile people in Iran who have protested, and they've already felt the consequence. I think there's two actresses who've been arrested recently, but this is something which I think observers internationally are seeing now, is that there's more and more of a backlash and a clampdown. What's been happening there with that? Because it does seem like the efforts of the regime to suppress all of this has really stepped up in the last few days.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they suppress anyone who shows the smallest denial about regime. Excuse me. So it includes the actresses, singers, students, university students. For example, one singer rapper in Kurdish area is now sentenced to death just because they found him on protest. And they assigned this term muharaba, which means it's an Arabic word, but it means fighting against God. And the penalty for that is usually death penalty. So, they target many different people, and it doesn't matter for them if it's just a normal citizen or it's a famous person.
And you mentioned your brother there. Obviously, how long has he been in prison, and does the family's fight continue to release him? I suppose there's obviously a lot of challenges around that as well.
Yeah, my brother has been in prison for over 2 years. And
you mentioned they were bogus.
Yeah, it's
what
bogus.
What exactly happened?
So him and his friend, they got arrested 2 years ago on the street, and they faced lots of torture, unfair trial, and they finally got 16 years sentence over bogus charges. One of them is like acting against the regime or acting against the government. It's just some like words that they assign to a lot of people that they are not pro them. So he is in prison now.
Yeah. I have one more question for you. I mean, what is your hope for what happens then in your home country? I mean, what is your ambition? Do you want to go back to Iran at some point, that it is a different country when you go back there? What is the feeling for people who are involved in this movement, which has, you know, captured the world's imagination? What is the hope? What is the outcome that you want to see happen in Iran?
Yeah, I think we are all hoping for a democratic government, for democracy, for a place that we can vote for whatever we believe in, and we have freedom to choose what we want to wear, basic rights, what we want to eat, what we want to think about, what we want to watch. And definitely, if we get to democracy, I'm sure myself and a lot of other Iranians who live abroad, they want to go back and be part of that change and help democracy.
Well, it is definitely something the world will be watching. Thank you for coming in today. Thank you for telling us your story.
So
and best wishes to your family, everyone at home. Ida, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That was Ida Younesi speaking to us about matters ongoing in Iran. Fascinating to be able to hear from someone firsthand as to just exactly what's going on and the family stakes for her as well.
I just really appreciate her coming in though and actually giving us a chance to hear that firsthand as well, because I think, like, you know, it's easy to get caught up in sort of be confused by some of the coverage. I think to actually hear her sit down and really break down, even when you asked her, Richard, about that looming presence of the morality police, actually, I thought that was really something that perhaps we don't consider, you know?
Absolutely. And the idea that they're parked in like the middle of a main square, like keeping an eye on how long people's
and when you leave the house that you're thinking, like, how am I dressing to dodge and avoid, you know? And like, it's just that looming presence.
Really, really brings it home, I think, doesn't it?
You really
have a human understanding of what it's like. And I think that, you know, you can read any coverage of it any sort of long read article about what's happening in Iran, but to hear what it's like to have that fear hanging over you, to be afraid for how your brother is getting on for prison, to be afraid for your friends and family back home in Tehran as well, and to what's actually going to happen to them over the next while as the clampdown continues. Just fascinating. Thanks so much to Aida for coming.
Absolutely. She asked us to mention as well that they have weekly protests every Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Spire if people want to gather and express their solidarity for people in Iran in the middle of the uprising that they're going through, the revolution as they put it. We mentioned Iran particularly in the context of what's going on in the World Cup, because it's been a very interesting week at the World Cup in terms of protests that people had planned to do, protests that they ended up not doing, alternative guerrilla protests that they ended up doing in the case of the German team, who posed today for their group picture before their game against Iran with their hands over their mouths because they claim to have been silenced by FIFA. But a lot of this going back to the proposal by seven European countries, including England, Wales, Germany, the Netherlands, to wear a One Love armband, which is a, by its own contention, a fairly anodyne way of expressing some support for the LGBTQ community. And then deciding not to do that because they were threatened with getting a yellow card if they wore an armband other than the one provided for them by FIFA. Hasn't gone down very well in a lot of parts of Europe, Richard.
No, and again, it just brings into question the very idea of bringing a World Cup to Qatar in the first place, where, you know, the message has been from Gianni Infantino, who we talked about last time around, and from the Qatari authorities, that everyone is going to be welcome in Qatar. Well, it's welcome if you do exactly what we say is appropriate. People might have also seen to step aside from, as you say, a fairly anodyne, fairly meek gesture, wearing the One Love armband in the first place, and how that went down. But people being, you know, Grant Wall, he's an American football journalist, being told he couldn't wear a rainbow T-shirt into cover America versus Wales, a former Welsh international footballer being told she couldn't wear a rainbow coloured bucket hat going in as well. This is consistently a problem which has, you know, FIFA said just wouldn't happen throughout all of this. And that any
seems like, I mean, again, I'm very much an outsider now, we're clear on this, but it seems from my outside perspective that FIFA has no control over the situation. It's like as if they waited until the last minute. What's with the beer has been banned in stadiums, is that right? They literally waited the last minute till FIFA couldn't be like, actually, no, we're not going to have it here.
The beer has almost become something of a canary in the coal mine, because FIFA have a huge sponsorship deal by Budweiser, who seemingly are now pursuing some damages for the loss of revenue
pursuing
by not being able to sell the beer inside the stadia, at least to those other than corporate tickets, because you're still allowed to have beer if you've got a corporate ticket, because apparently it's not that offensive to the culture if you're paying for it. Aside from Gianni Infantino's just preposterous statement at the start of the weekend that, like, oh, today I feel Qatari, today I feel gay, today, and suggesting that he knows what it's like to be marginalised because he used to get teased for having red hair. Such a wild thing that I don't even know whether it needs a kind of a deconstruction. But it sort of seems like FIFA's really thrown in the towel, because when the World Cup was awarded to Qatar, part of the justification for it was that football could be this agent for change, that it would almost be this way of trying to spread Western tolerance and liberal values to parts of the world where it's not there. And then as soon as that turned out not to be the case, then FIFA saying, please don't politicise football, despite themselves having openly invited us to do so in the first place.
It's the same justification that's given any time you hold a major tournament or major sporting events in a regime which isn't welcoming, or that has, you know, repressive views about, you know, LGBTQ rights, about women's rights, about race, about, you know, freedom of speech, that you always hear this thing. Well, it's about, you know, this is an opening up, and that will, you know, this will introduce, you know, new ideas to this country. And it's like, no, it's not. It never happens. It's absolute bunkum. It never happens.
Can I ask you just about the actual sport, the actual football? How's that going? Is it interesting? Are you enjoying it? Are you watching it? You said last week you weren't super excited about it. Like, are people getting, I know the Argentina game was quite a shock the other day.
Which is in itself maybe a weird way of showing that football will always prevail even when it's against your instinct to watch it. Because I remember openly doubting last week whether I'd kind of get into it when a footballing storyline broke out. Argentina losing their opening game to unfancied Saudi Arabia, and prospectively now a favourite for the competition going out in the very early stages. That has awakened me to it a little bit. At the time of recording, Germany are also losing to Japan, which maybe is another fuel to the fire. Dare we say it's coming home? Maybe we'll discuss in future weeks whether it's coming home or not.
The football, I think, has been hit and miss. It's just one of those things where, like, it's very hard to avoid a World Cup when it's on.
Yeah.
When I think it's interesting. There was a lot of different views on this, because I think who else but Roy Keane, really, to sort of walk into it and sort of address it head on. Especially because it was actually interesting. So the clip went viral Roy Keane
it's
saying.
Of him speaking to ITV Football saying that it just shouldn't,
be here. The way they treat gay people, the way they treat migrant workers, just dismissing human rights, it shouldn't be here in the first place. He sort of made a point to do that. It's interesting. That clip has been seen by a lot of people. Mightn't have seen Graham Souness, who was on the panel with them beforehand, sort of saying, well, look, it's not a perfect world. And Roy Keane seemed to have the ideas like, well, I'm not sort of letting you go hand-waving this. Mm. I'm going to go back there and I'm going to have a go with this.
Has there been pushback against Roy Keane, though, for saying all of that while being in Qatar facilitating a World Cup happening?
Lots of it, yeah. Mm. So there's really two camps on it. There's the fair play Roy, he's there and he's saying it, you know.
Like he's calling it out.
Calling it out there.
Yeah, it was just kind of high risk, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's very easy to go over there and say, like a lot of other pundits did, saying, oh, I'm going to go over there, I'm going to highlight human rights and then not do anything.
They're maybe frightened, I guess.
Well,
you know, it's hard to know, isn't it? Like, is it reasonable to say people are frightened, or like, I guess we don't know if you're not there. Like, it's difficult to measure. Like,
I mean, there's some like I can understand people saying that, but I'd say as well that like it's very easy for Western journalists and reporters who are going to be protected all the way through it to get away with saying things which other people certainly would not.
Yeah.
But the point is, a lot of people were actually quite critical of Roy Keane for going over in the first place. Saying that, well, like if you feel so much about it, why didn't you just boycott in the first place? But I suppose the counterview to that is, well, if he did boycott and didn't go over, well, then nobody on
to say
ITV might have heard it over that course of the day.
Which is an interesting debate which is going to go on. Let's return to one item which dominated last week's podcast for absolutely good reason, which of course was the death of Vicky Phelan and the discussion that we had about how much or how little of her campaign she got to fulfil during her life. Zara, as it happens, only today you were attending a press conference with Gabriel Scally where that was pretty much the subject in question.
Yeah, so I've actually just come straight from that today. So this is the report. It's 39 pages, a chunky report. This is, he's saying, his final report. This was basically Gabriel Scally looking at, he'd done 50 recommendations initially back in September of 2018 when that first report came out. It was to look at how are the 50 recommendations coming along. He said, look, there was huge progress made. He gave credit to those who had implemented that progress, but he said that there was still a need for duty of candor. So obviously that policy of mandatory open disclosure, that's still not there. And, you know, he said it's really disappointing, actually, after 4 years to still be in a situation where that doesn't exist. He also spoke crucially about the culture around that and the use of language. Mm. So when, you know, there's a conversation about telling a patient where something has gone wrong, that the word should is still being used as opposed to would or must. I thought that was really interesting that he was picking up on the use of language around all of that. So Lorraine Walsh, who's a really obviously close personal friend of Vicky Phelan's and one of the main cervical check campaigners herself, I was talking to her after the report today to get her take on it. And here's what she had to say.
We sat around the table this morning to review the report, and every time we reviewed a report before, Vicky was at the table, and you know she had a huge input, and we really missed her today. And yes, she would be grateful for the changes, but equally, I suppose, concerned about the things that are still outstanding, and in relation to the culture. I go back to culture again, changing people's mindset, and then when they change, you will find that the people that are using the system will then gain trust in it. But that won't happen until they acknowledge that. And that's what Vicky wanted. Vicky always told the truth. And people just felt that they knew her because she was always an open and honest person. And they trusted her. So maybe the health service needs to take a leaf out of Vicky's book and start going down that route.
So Vicky always told the truth is the resounding remark there from Lorraine Walsh, and maybe the health service needs to take a leaf out of Vicky's book, which are some very strong words following the publication of this report. Like a couple of other things that came up was just Gabriel Scally was saying today, like there is actually an absence of a complaints mechanism for people in terms of coming forward, and there's still an over-reliance on the judicial system. And we talked about this last week. Gabriel Scally is really clear in saying like dragging women through the High Court and having them have to speak about really intimate details of their lives is just absolutely not an acceptable way to deal with this. He also has welcomed the plans to bring back cytology to Ireland. So this is something that came up in the Dáil last week. We've known about this for a little while. There's a new lab that's been built at the site at the Coombe. The plan would be long term to bring all your smear tests back to Ireland. That's definitely in the works. It's been difficult in terms of the lab isn't up and running. I think they're having difficulty in terms of getting staff to work because cytology left Ireland. So the smears were all sent abroad. Yeah. So trying to attract talent and like like, you know, we've talked about the health service in Ireland and trying to attract talent. So look, it kind of speaks for itself in a lot of ways. There's big challenges around that. But he said, look, that obviously needs to be done. He said that all the screening was now being done at one accredited lab in New Jersey in the United States at the moment. So look, he said there has been good progress. You know, he's, you know, positive about that, but definitely there's a lot of issues, very important issues that remain outstanding.
Now, it's the middle of the last week of November, which means it's probably safe to start talking Christmas films, which then leads to a very open-ended question, which, and I hope this lands, because it might not otherwise. Anything festive that strikes you about the number 8?
Well, it is a lot of legs, David.
It is a lot of legs, David. It is. Nailed it. 10 points for Zara King. 8 is a lot of legs, David, because it has been, it's 20
we've lost
years.
Richard.
It's 20 years, but we've already lost Richard. Richard can just sit out the Love Actually chat.
I suggest that we do this. So.
Okay, now you want to boycott it.
No, I mean...
This is your World Cup. It's been 20 years since Love Actually.
I can't
believe
it.
That's frightening, isn't it?
It's frightening. I love this movie. I know people will say it's problematic in parts, but let's just focus on the Christmas spirit. I love it. Mm. My favourite part of that movie is the Heathrow reunions, you know, at the end of the movie, and they're all coming through at Christmas.
Nice bit.
Because every year at Christmas, I love doing the Home for Christmas story. Actually, I've just found out this week that Editor Joe has me working till the 23rd of December, Joe.
Thanks, Editor Joe.
So actually, I'm going to spend those 2 days at Dublin Airport, Joe, just so you know now. And I'm going to film people coming home for Christmas, and I'm buzzing about that.
The reason why Love Actually is also newsworthy this week is because the stars of the movie, the surviving ones at least, have recorded a 20-year reunion special for ABC television in America. Note to any management, by the way, if they're listening or can't hear this, or if we have any sway at all, please secure the Irish broadcasting rights of that, because I desperately want to see it. Richard is
desperately want to see it. What could you
that
possibly learn?
Because I hate Uncle Jamie and I want to see whether Uncle Jamie manages to rehabilitate in any way. What would you not want to see it? But do you not want to go back and revisit classics and then see how why they all think of things and whether it still has the same joy for them 20 years on? As it does for those of us who loved it the first time we saw it and still watch it.
I don't want to hear or see Richard Curtis do anything ever again.
Oh no.
Just don't.
Oh,
but anyway, God. I can see, I remember we watched it multiple times, Ara, when we were sharing
multiple
a house.
Multiple times.
Festive favourite for many people.
Yep. It's my Putting Up the Tree movie. Like, I love it.
I can't believe you've just dropped an anti-Richard Curtis bomb. That's the end
this
of the group.
Very spicy.
We're not going to make it to season 3.
It's not very spicy. Believe me, that's not a spicy take.
Would you go out of your way to watch it?
Like 100%, I will watch it. Yeah, like I will seek it out. I will definitely watch that. Yeah, 100%. I will definitely. I mean, Joni Mitchell, both sides now.
Please don't get into the Joni Mitchell both sides.
Gav, I cannot believe that you're going in on Joni Mitchell and both sides now.
I'm not going in on Joni Mitchell. It just doesn't do anything for me, and I think that it's a little bit lazy to think that there's some gravitas associated with her recording the song.
What did Alan Rickman say about it?
To further your musical education or something.
Yeah, like that was good.
Okay. Yes, that was it. Fat Harry, before he bought a necklace for someone else. That is coming up soon next week on ABC television. So I hope that we find it on our own channels, because I do really want to see that. And Richard takes
Lies.
Issue with that.
You're a liar.
You and Kira can come around to mine and we'll all watch it together.
Let's do that.
That's
right.
It. You're not.
I'll be standing outside with my cue cards saying, I don't want to watch this.
All right. That's all.
To me, you are perfect.
From Richard Chambers, thank you.
Thank you.
Despite your hating of Richard Curtis, Zara King, thank you. Thank you for listening and watching. And thank you also to Killian Ginnity, who has been a really
indispensable
part of the group chat up until now. This is his last episode because he's moving on to Pastures New. Killian, thank you for everything and wish you all the best. From me, from Richard, from Zara, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.